Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, lyrics, Krypton Conan and Vivendi. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
As always, we are going to take a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last 7 days. A week when, well, you just went and did basically this on Six Music with Steve Lamacq. I think you might be getting ideas above your station.
I thought it was just time to try out alternative co-hosts. And that opportunity came up. And I thought, well, I'll go and see how that works. See if Steve Lamacq asks more interesting questions when we're talking about the streaming business.
Well, apparently he doesn't, because I'm still here.
And
maybe he didn't want to come and
he's a
take
very
over.
Busy guy, isn't he? I'd have to slowly suggest these things to him.
I think your opportunity might have passed.
Do you think I should have brought it up, embarrassed him while we were on air, saying, will you come and co-host the podcast? And then he might have felt, because he was on air, he was obliged to say yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's how it works.
So I went on Six Music to talk about the streaming business and all of the dissecting the digital dollar stuff. Actually, I've done 2 programmes on the BBC.
All right.
Recently.
Have you?
I did one on Six Music last week and then one on Radio 4 a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, I didn't hear that.
A few weeks ago on Moneybox.
Oh, yeah.
And very different, obviously, Radio 4 versus Six Music. Not least because the Radio 4 show, I mean, I wasn't the only guest on that. There was a presenter, 2 other guests, and 3 people. So you know how we have Matt sitting in the little room here, making sure that everything doesn't explode.
Yes.
And that everything's working.
Most of the time.
Well, on that programme, they had 3 Matts all sitting there making sure. I don't know what they were expecting to explode, that we'd need 3 of them to ensure.
They've got
that,
more stuff at the BBC, haven't they?
To make sure everything
might explode.
So I've done 2 programmes recently on the BBC. The reason I'm mentioning that is, has been interesting, because quite often when I'm asked to go and comment on digital dollar stuff, on other media, particularly broadcast media, normally they give you like 90 seconds, because usually you're on some sort of business news program. Music's always the end. Finally, on if you go on a business news program, anything to do with music clearly comes at the end of the program.
Yeah, one day I might write a book about the times that you've been bumped.
Because you're the flippant, silly end of the program. It's all the serious stuff, the proper companies who make proper money doing proper things. And then, ha-ha, let's talk about the music industry.
That's stupid, isn't it?
90 seconds at the end of the programme. So they'll normally go, so explain how streaming works. Oh, you've got 60 seconds. And as listeners to this podcast will know, it's kind of complicated. So in 60 seconds, pretty much all you can say is, well,
it's complicated.
Spotify and there's Apple and money comes in and it gets shared out and it's kind of complicated. And then it's time for the news. Whereas both the Moneybox programme and the interview on Six Music, they actually had not quite as much time as we have to talk about stuff. But nevertheless, there was actually an opportunity to try and explain in more detail how the stream business works, how the money comes in, how it's shared out between artists and labels and writers and publishers on a consumption share basis and all of that. So it's been quite nice to be given a little bit more time to talk about these things. Obviously, on this podcast, I'm given all the time in the world.
I know. It would be better if all of Six Music's listeners came and listened to this podcast instead of you having to go onto Six Music.
Well, I did give the podcast a tiny little plug at the end of that interview. So,
yeah, so welcome all new listeners.
Assuming that's how that's
looking forward to that bump.
How it works, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that's happened. So, if you thought I went into it in detail on Steve Lamacq's show in my 12-minute interview, wait till the next time we're talking about streaming. We're not really talking about streaming this week, although we kind of are, but from
a
very different perspective. But wait till I get on my usual streaming monologues in future editions, and that's something to look forward to.
I feel like we've now just, I don't want people to think we're just bragging. I mean, it's not, I haven't done anything. I'm not bragging, but you are. You're quite a braggy person.
Well, you brought it up.
Well, but if we're talking about BBC stuff, I think we should, I'm going to plug Tune on BBC Scotland.
Yes.
Also available on the iPlayer, a new music magazine show about the music scene in Scotland. Not just Scottish artists, but a lot of Scottish artists and venues in Scotland. It's a very good show. And I have been enjoying watching it. It's on every Thursday night. And I am trying to tell everyone about it because I want it to be a thing. I also want them to make it about other areas of the UK because there's a lot going on in Scotland I didn't know about. So this show has been quite useful.
Obviously, over the years, particularly since the demise of the Top of the Pops type show and the Saturday morning music type show, there have been various attempts to create a music programme that isn't a documentary about the Beach Boys that goes out on BBC Four. It's about new music, and most of those attempts haven't really worked.
No, no one's ever made a good music show, ever.
Since Amstel era pop world.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's quite a long time ago now.
And that was
it?
A different sort of music, really.
Yeah, so that's the best part of two decades we're talking about now, since anyone's made anything good related to music on TV.
And whenever people make not very good music television programmes, and then they don't work because they're not very good, some boss somewhere in TV land will say, oh, well, that's because in the YouTube age, there's no space for actual proper music television programming. But you're saying, actually, this feels like it's the right kind of program. So therefore, there should be a space for it. And although it's technically a BBC Scotland show going out on the new BBC Scotland TV channel that launched earlier this year, in this iPlayer age, that's kind of irrelevant. Anyone can tune in.
Yes.
And you are recommending that people do so.
Yes, you should tune in to tune so that they make more of it. It's really good.
And obviously, as you say, it's about the Scottish music scene, not just Scottish artists, artists that are popular in Scotland, and most artists that are popular in Scotland are also popular in England and everywhere else. So although a lot of it is kind of taking place in venues in Scotland and stuff like that, actually, in terms of the music that's being covered, it's of interest to anybody anywhere in the world.
I suppose there's a mix of, like, the first one, they have one main act on each episode. The first one was Frank Carter and the Rattlesnakes. And they had some really, amazingly well-filmed footage of Frank Carter on the first episode. The second episode, the main act was Churches, playing a homecoming show in Glasgow. And they had three live tracks for them. That was really good. But then it delves into other things, like two sisters in the middle of nowhere who started a riot girl band. They had a feature on, like, the metal scene in Dundee. It was really interesting. They had a feature on a kind of alternative grime scene in Glasgow. That was really interesting. These, like, all acts who wouldn't have been aware of without this show. So it's really interesting to see. Like, I mean, obviously the BBC is the place where new music is most likely to be supported in the media, but this is, like, a lot of kind of really kind of new, fresh music that isn't being kind of talked about that much in the wider music world.
So to conclude, stop listening to this nonsense.
Go and watch some TV.
Go over to the BBC Sounds app to listen to my interview on Steve Lamacq, and to the BBC iPlayer to watch Tune, and then forget about this nonsense. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Well, it wasn't what I intended to say, but it does appear to be what I've said. And so, yeah, that is basically what I'm saying.
But on the off chance people stick around for this nonsense.
Oh, right. I was just going to say goodbye.
What?
Are we going to actually do this?
Well, we might as well, as we've both bothered to come into the studio to do it.
I suppose.
What nonsense are we covering?
Well, this week we are going to be discussing Crepton Conan appearing in Parliament to discuss drill, and when the hell Vivendi is going to sell half of Universal. But first, it was a week of people getting angry about lyrics last week, and not the usual getting angry about what lyrics actually say, just lyrics being in places. That's what people were angry about. People don't like lyrics being in places.
Yeah, so basically this is actually a copyright story.
Yeah.
And to do with digital stuff, and in one case to do with streaming stuff, but it's a copyright story specifically about lyrics and the displaying of lyrics.
Yes. So Genius accused Google of stealing lyrics from its website. And then publishing company Wixen said that Pandora was displaying lyrics from its catalogue without permission.
So if we take the first of those stories first.
Why not?
Genius, formerly Rap Genius,
which
began as a sort of wiki-type community, didn't it? Where lyrics for rap and hip-hop was posted, and then people could amend it, and then, crucially, people could comment on it, couldn't they, and analyse it and put little notes. And it all began, as the name would suggest, with rap, but then it became quite popular quite quickly, and it slowly but surely started posting lyrics from a wider range of genres, ultimately rebranding as Genius as a result of that. In the early days of Rap Genius, we reported on them for two reasons, and kind of both of those reasons are weirdly linked to this story. So first of all, they had a spat with Google once before, didn't they?
Yeah, so in 2013, Google delisted then Rap Genius from its search engine.
The entire site.
The entire site.
So no pages, no links for Rap Genius were appearing in Google search.
And that was because Google said Rap Genius had breached its rules on incentivized reciprocal links.
Because that was the era when you used to get bloggers to link to your stuff. Because the more sites were linking to your stuff, that would then put you up the Google ranking.
Yes.
And so Google accused Rap Genius of incentivizing bloggers to link through to their sites to screw with the SEO, which contravened Google rules. Hence why Google has said, right, we're going to completely delist Rap Genius. Rap Genius then made good on whatever the criticisms were and did quite quickly end up back in Google search. And that's one of the Rap Genius stories that we previously wrote about. The other thing was, in the early days, when they first started aggregating all of those rap lyrics, they weren't licensed
No.
by any of the music publishers who actually own the copyright in those lyrics. And so there were some spats early on where various publishers were threatening to sue what became Genius. Ultimately, they did licensing deals with most of the publishers. Actually, at the time of the Google spat, they had done some of their licensing deals, but not all of their licensing deals with the publishers. Which was interesting at the time because those publishers who had yet to license Genius, so who were still bad-mouthing Genius for publishing their lyrics without permission, some of those did note that if, as a copyright owner, you say to Google, that website doesn't have any licenses, they're publishing infringing material, you should delist them, Google will usually say, oh, it's really hard to delist entire websites. We can't do that. But then the minute they broke Google rules, Google were like, oh, we'll completely take them out of our database. But that all happened quite some time ago. With the new dispute between Genius and Google, it's the other way round.
Yes.
In that Genius are dissing Google. And it's all because, relatively recently, Google started adding to what it calls the information boxes about tracks and songs when you search for them on Google search. So the information box is the background information that Google actually displays directly whenever you search for a track or a song. So rather than just immediately sending you off to Wikipedia or to a record label site or to Discogs or Music Brains or whatever, Google actually displays the information box, which has various information about the track. And that information box has existed for quite some time. But over the years, they've added more and more information.
Yes. And now if you search for the lyrics in a song, those lyrics will come up in the actual Google search.
And obviously for a site like Rap Genius, and there are other lyric platforms, aren't there? Some of which are licensed and some of which are not. But if you're a lyric platform, obviously it's quite annoying that Google has actually started listing, not necessarily all the lyrics, depends how long the song is, but a chunk of the lyrics directly there in the information box. Because it means if somebody is searching Google for lyrics, they may well be happy with what's in the information box. So they'll never actually click on a link to go to Genius or anywhere else to actually see the lyrics, where those lyric platforms can then monetize that traffic. So I would imagine Genius were a bit pissed off when Google started to do that anyway.
Yeah.
But the actual dispute that they've gone public with is the allegation that some of the lyrics that are appearing in those information boxes on the Google platform are actually coming out of the Rap Genius database, even though Google and Genius don't have any formal alliance to allow that.
Yes. Now, you might say, well, how could they possibly know? Because the lyrics of a song are the lyrics of a song.
Yes.
I mean, if you've ever done a Google search for lyrics, you'll know that that's not always the case, because they're quite often wrong. But Genius, basically suspecting that whoever, I don't know whether they suspected Google at the time, but they suspected that their lyrics were being lifted for other purposes by third parties. So they put a little code into some of their lyrics, which is basically a sequence of different types of apostrophes that in Morse code spell out red-handed.
Yeah, so anybody who has ever done any graphic design or has ever kind of done any web design or email bulletin design will know that there are different kinds of apostrophes.
Yeah.
And the main difference are the straight line apostrophes and the curly line apostrophes. And the reason why you know that if you're a designer is, well, first of all, good graphic design would always say that you should be consistent on the kind of apostrophes you use. So old school designing magazines, one thing you used to have to do as a graphic designer before you went to press was to go through and check that you'd either use all straight quotes or curly quotes. But also, once things have gone online, sometimes with certain browsers and certain email readers, some apostrophes work and some don't.
Yeah.
So you become aware of it, don't you, when you're sending out HTML emails, oh, we have to make it a certain sort of apostrophe. Otherwise, for some people, the apostrophes won't be there and people will think that we've used the wrong its
in a sentence. Yeah, people think you don't know. People will email you and say your grammar is terrible.
And it's no, your system has stripped out all of the apostrophes. But what is interesting is that Genius have exploited the fact that these different apostrophes exist. Yeah, you're right, to put some almost Morse code. So presumably it was straight line for a dash and a curly for a dot.
I'm guessing so,
the other way around. But you'd think it'd be that way around, wouldn't you? So that if somebody took their lyrics and pasted them straight into another database without tidying up any punctuation, then it may well be that the same combination of straight and curly quotes are in that other database, and Genius are saying that means you must have sourced those lyrics originally from our database, and we didn't give you permission to do that. And the allegation is that somehow those lyrics are ending up in the Google information boxes.
Yes, so that's what Genius says is happening. And it says it first alerted Google to this in 2017, and nothing has happened. Google has denied that this is actually happening at all, and so there's nothing to fix. Genius obviously is saying, no, no, our code is in there. You have stolen these lyrics from us. And so it's ended up now, this has come to light because Genius has gone to the Wall Street Journal and the Wall Street Journal has done an article on it. And so now it's all out in public. It also brings up the fact Google itself doesn't license lyrics directly for those information boxes. It uses a number of licensing partners, one of them being LyricFind, which is one of the bigger aggregators of lyrics for licensing purposes on the internet. So that company has come under fire. It also denies lifting lyrics from Genius. It says everything's created in-house by its staff and done properly. And so there is no issue to sort out. Genius is imagining things.
Although it's interesting that Google initially was saying to Genius, there's no problem. And then, as I understand it, when Wall Street Journal approached Google, they restated, we get our lyrics from our licensing partners. We're not just scraping other people's websites. It can't possibly be that we're taking Genius's lyrics. Wall Street Journal then went to LyricFind as the big aggregator that Google uses. LyricFind put out its statement saying, we compiled all the lyrics ourselves. It can't be us.
LyricFind's also disputed some of the Wall Street Journal's reporting.
But I thought what was interesting, as I understand it, as I say, is that once the Wall Street Journal article was online and out there and people started talking about it, Google then put out another statement saying, oh, we're now investigating this.
Yeah.
Which was kind of interesting because it's like, well, your previous statement suggested you'd already investigated it and now you're investigating what you investigated and you're doing an investigation. So that investigation is ongoing. So everybody is kind of denying that anybody is ripping off Genius's lyrics, but Genius are adamant that they are for the clever little apostrophe thing that we talked about before. So we're yet to really get to the bottom of this, although one theory has been floating around amongst some songwriters who I am connected to through various social networks. And it's a theory that I can almost believe, which is Google is getting a lot of the lyrics that appear in its information boxes off LyricFind. LyricFind's an aggregator. It has deals with lots of music publishers. I don't quite know how those licensing deals work, but it wouldn't surprise me if once LyricFind has done a deal with a music publisher, that music publisher is then pumping the lyrics of the songs that it publishes, that it controls, through to LyricFind, that then pump them through to Google and they appear in the information boxes. But where is the publisher getting the lyrics from?
Yeah.
Because, has to be said, the music industry has not always done a particularly good job of properly documenting lyrics, which often begins with the songwriters never properly even writing them down because they conceive it in the studio, the track's recorded. And I know some music publishers have traditionally had members of staff who, once a song is out there, have to put together the official lyrics. And that might be partly from the songwriter sending in notes. And sometimes it is that person having to listen to the track, write the lyrics up, and then phone up the songwriter and say, is this the lyrics that you thought? Hence why when you Google lyrics sometimes online, sometimes the lyrics don't agree from all the different sources. But one of the theories that was doing the round, as I say, this is just a theory some songwriters were floating around on social networks, is that maybe somewhere some of the publishers that LyricFind have deals with, who probably have quite junior members of staff who are responsible for keeping their database of lyrics, if they're charged with the task of typing lyrics up, maybe they're doing a Google search on the assumption that somebody's already typed them up, which is a good assumption to make. And then maybe they're checking them with the songwriter and the songwriter's just going, yeah, they're probably right. And maybe that means that somebody in an official capacity is grabbing the Rap Genius curated lyrics, passing them through a network, which ultimately ends up in the Google information box. And that might be what all of this is about. The other interesting thing, which almost brings us to the second lyrical story that we're here to talk about today, is if Rap Genius was to go legal in its dispute with Google, which they're not currently suggesting that they will.
No, they're just cross.
They're just cross and they're going public about it. But if they did, raises an interesting question, because neither Google nor Genius, nor LyricFind, none of these companies actually own the copyright in the lyrics. Because The music publisher owns the copyright in the lyrics, and or the songwriter owns the copyright in the lyrics, and they've appointed a publisher to manage those lyrics on their behalf. So you've got all of these databases of lyrics owned by companies who own the database, but don't actually own the lyrics within the database. Which means that if you feel that somebody has scraped your database and then used the content from the database, you can't sue because the lyrics have been infringed, because that's not your copyright. The only person who could sue for that would be the publisher and or the writer who actually controls the lyrics. So what would you sue for? You'd have to sue because...
The design of your apostrophes.
Well, could you say that by putting in apostrophes, that's enough of a creative process? But then that would mean that that's an adaptation and you would have needed permission from the songwriter to change their apostrophes?
You could
try and say there's intellectual property in the...
Is there copyright in apostrophes?
No, I can't believe that there is, although it wouldn't surprise me if some American lawyer somewhere wouldn't have a go at trying to argue that. So you'd be like, okay, what IP is there actually in the database? So it would get really complicated and messy if anyone tried to go illegal on any of this. But if you are actually the copyright owner in the lyrics and you think that your lyrics are popping up somewhere on the internet without permission, well, then that's much more straightforward. You can sue for copyright infringement, which brings us to the second of our lyric stories this week.
Yes, because on this one, the legal grounds are a bit more clear cut. Wixon Music Publishing, which represents songs by the likes of Tom Petty, Neil Young, The Doors, Tom Morello, The Black Keys, and Sophie B. Hawkins, amongst others, reckons that Pandora has been making lyrics from its catalogue available via its service without permission.
Yeah, because most of the streaming services in recent years have been adding ever-increasing lyric functions within their apps, so that rather than just being able to listen to somebody sing the lyrics, you can actually read the lyrics and, I suppose, sing along if you like in a karaoke fashion. So lots of streaming services now offer that within the app. Some of them are also then doing stuff with social media with those lyrics. So, for example, last week in amongst all of this, Deezer announced something, didn't they?
They were going to let you put bits of lyrics into Instagram stories. And that was through a partnership with LyricFind, LyricFind throughout all of this is the unifying factor because it's involved in all of these stories.
Which is because they are by far the biggest aggregator of lyrics. And the reason why a company like LyricFind is necessary is because if you're a streaming service and you do all of those deals with the record industry and the music publishers and the collecting societies, the sorts of stuff I would be talking about if this was a dissecting the digital dollar bit of setlist, which it isn't, but you do all the deals to get the rights to stream recordings of songs on your services, and that includes deals with publishers and then collecting societies that work for publishers and songwriters, but none of those deals give you permission to actually display lyrics within your app. So if you want to display lyrics in your app, you need a separate license for that, and you can either get that from the music publisher, or to save you time, you can try and find an aggregator who's already done all the deals, hence why LyricFind exists. It's done deals with lots and lots of publishers, so if you want to put lyrics in your app, if you want to do some clever thing with Instagram stories, then the easiest way to do that is to go to LyricFind and piggyback on the licensing deals they've already done. But that only works when you're using the lyrics of songs published by publishers who have done a LyricFind deal. And in the Wixon versus Pandora case, the basic point is that Wixon hasn't done a deal with LyricFind, yet Pandora is seemingly relying on the LyricFind license for the lyrics in its app.
Yes. So, and in this case, it has actually gone legal. We know about this because Wixon filed a lawsuit last week in which it said, Pandora has built its business in large part on unauthorized uses of Wixon's musical compositions by displaying the lyrics to the musical compositions on its service, including on its website and app. Now, I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that Pandora has built its business in large part, no less, on displaying Wixon's lyrics. But it does still remain that if Wixon hasn't given permission for those lyrics to be used and they're on there, then there is infringement occurring.
Yeah, Wixon are renowned for being quite proactive when it comes to enforcing their rights, particularly in the digital space. They were the publisher that sued Spotify in that multi-billion dollar lawsuit that did ultimately get settled. That was over the music that was streaming, not lyrics. But yes, if this does get to court, and assuming that Pandora don't find some way of wiggling out of the actual infringement, either by saying, oh, we found a license that Wixon didn't know about where actually we are covered, or some other technicality under copyright law that says, oh, we're not liable for infringement. But assuming the facts as Wixon present them are true, which is Wixon has never licensed its lyrics for display to Pandora directly. It hasn't licensed them to LyricFind. Pandora is displaying lyrics in its app for Wixon published songs. Assuming all of that stood up in court, then you would start to then have the conversation around, well, what is the value of streaming service apps having lyrics displaying? And what value does it have to the streaming service? What value does it have to the average user? Have you ever actually overtly gone looking for lyrics within any streaming app? I mean, they do sometimes randomly pop up without you wanting them.
In the Spotify app, they have a thing with Genius where they pop up and it gives you little kind of information about behind the scenes of the making of the song and things like that and the meaning of the lyrics. But that kind of comes up automatically. So sometimes I see it. But I don't think I've ever actively looked for lyrics on a streaming service.
Because it would be academically interesting if this dispute forced a debate around, okay, well, what is the value to the streaming service of those lyrics, and therefore what damages should be paid if a service is displaying lyrics in this way without license? Although, of course, this is an American case, so Wixon would almost certainly push for so-called statutory damages, which is where you can say, providing you can prove the infringement was willful, and they're claiming that there is evidence to say that it was, that you can just sue for $150,000 per infringement, oblivious of what the actual value of the infringement was. And so then if you sue over 100 songs, 100 infringements, 100 times $150,000, you end up with another stupid figure copyright lawsuit. So it will be interesting to see how this one plays out.
And indeed the Genius case as well, whether there is any case or it's just the case of Genius being cross and just having to live with that.
Maybe the clever people that came up with the apostrophe Morse code ruse could come up with some way of inserting a virus into the lyric so that if a website displays them without permission, it then screws up the website or something like that. That would be one way of doing it.
I think there might be grounds for a different sort of legal case.
If that even could be done. But hey, look at that. A load of lyrical news last week for us to talk about.
Still to come, an update on Vivendi's universal share sale, plus a bit of fireside chat. But now, actually, still sticking with lyrics to some extent, rappers Krept, Conan, Skengdo and AM took part in a debate at the Houses of Parliament last week on the criminalisation of drill artists.
Yeah, so to an extent, this is a continuation of something we have talked about before on Setlist.
Yes.
Which is various people in the political community and in various police forces around the UK, and particularly in London, being critical of certain artists and certain tracks being created within the UK drill scene, and then blaming those artists and their music, and especially their video content on YouTube, for inciting violence within certain communities, particularly in London. And of course, that all then plays into the rise of knife crime and the tragic stabbings that we're seeing in London with an increased frequency. And even though anyone who's ever thought about anything for more than 10 minutes knows that when certain artists or certain musical scenes or certain tracks are somehow linked to gang violence, say, it's insanely simplistic to suggest that if we could just ban the music and censor the artist, all the violence would go away. But there have been various efforts over recent years to silence some of the drill artist acts who have been criticised in this way. So by that I mean, for example, getting their content taken off YouTube, but also some, I think, very dubious court orders banning artists from performing certain tracks. And so that story has been running. Occasionally it gets media coverage, but actually all of that is happening behind the scenes. But Krept and Conan in particular have become increasingly vocal about this in recent years, being critical of both the police and the politicians and the other authorities who are instigating all of this, with a really interesting and, I think, intellectually sound argument, which is to say, actually, what all of this is doing is damaging musical initiatives within these communities. Initiatives which are ultimately about taking people who are involved in the gangs which are leading to violent activity and giving them projects that they can put their energies and ambitions into and hopefully move them away from the more violent activity. So that's what Krept and Conan and others have been saying, but Krept and Conan have now launched a petition and they seem to be leading the campaign
late. Because, well, Krept and Conan, like, not drill artists themselves, but they have been outspoken about this because they see this as kind of just a continuation of, you know, like before drill being criminalised, there were accusations that grime was causing violence and, you know, drum and bass. Basically, any music made by young black men is faced with these accusations. But drill is where it's actually been criminalised. And so they have, although they're not making drill themselves, they're using their profile to speak out against this. And as you say, they recently launched a petition calling on the police to stop using the Serious Crimes Act to criminalise drill rappers. And what using that legislation means is that you're not just censoring artists. It's not just the police asking YouTube to take down certain things because they say it incites violence. They're taking out injunctions against artists, like you said, to stop them performing certain tracks. And if they breach those injunctions, then in theory, they could go to prison. I mean, that's not even in theory. That's been the reason that Skengdo and AM were at this debate was because they have been to prison because of that. Earlier this year, they were jailed because they broke an injunction ordering them not to perform their track, Attempted 1.0. And so they were there at this debate saying, this is crazy. We're just making music. The music's helping us get away from the violence and the crime that's around us. And Krept and Conan as well, like I said, they're not in that scene. They're a bit older, but they've both said they had a, you know, quite violent childhoods. They did get involved in violence and crime, and music helped them get away from that. It wasn't that they were necessarily targeted by police for making music, but they see music as the thing that got them out of that world and helped them get away. And now they're seeing younger artists making drill or just, you know, just generally making music as a means to get somewhere else in their lives. And actually, the police are coming along and saying, no, you can't make that music. And it's just pushing them back into a position of violence and crime. And Krept and Conan have actually released a track alongside this petition called Ban Drill. It's got a short film attached to it as well, where it explicitly accuses the police of basically being responsible for people's deaths because of this campaign against drill.
Yeah, and as you've said on a number of occasions, it's interesting that Krept and Conan themselves aren't actually part of the specific scene that is currently being targeted, but obviously are honing in on the fact that you can track a narrative back over decades of similar action that has been taken over other genres that have come out.
Yeah, and I guess the previous kind of policing issue and that kind of wider issue, it was the use of Form 696, which we've discussed on the show before, and how that was kind of used to stop grime and hip-hop shows going ahead. It was very kind of specifically worded. It was sort of put forward as like, oh no, this is for all events. We have to just check that it's all going to be okay. But it was very specifically targeted at a certain type of music.
Not least by it only applying to events where people were performing to a backing track.
Yeah.
Which kind of made it really obvious which genres they were going after. But I think the fact that you've got artists from outside the scene that's specifically being targeted now going so vocal on this and leading on this is kind of important, because it means it's not just the people who are being directly targeted who are saying this is wrong. It's other people coming in and saying, yeah, this is wrong. It's a continuation of bad stuff that happened before. And actually, as far as I can see, when it comes to the freedom of expression issues which are coming out of this, and you sense that, although, as I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment, the MP Diane Abbott, who took part in the debate in Parliament that you mentioned at the start of this section, did point out that where videos and or audio or performances are directly inciting violence, then yes, we understand that police have to take action, and we understand that police are underfunded, and there are all sorts of political issues which are making this a very difficult situation that everyone is trying to navigate. But at the same time, I think there are some quite important free speech issues here where this piece of criminal law is being used to censor people, to criminalize people for performing a song. And a lot of that is happening in relatively low courts. I suspect a lot of the artists who are being targeted can't afford experienced legal representation. And I think sometimes with free speech issues, that can happen, that you end up with precedents being set in low courts with non-specialist legal representation. And once those precedents are set, then police forces latch onto that and more people getting affected. And there are some fundamental freedom of expression topics going on here, in addition to the fact that a lot of this isn't going to solve the situation which we're trying to solve.
No.
That should be aired in public. And so kudos to Krept and Conan for A, leading the petition on this, which everyone should go and check out, B, creating some art around this in terms of the track, and helping to instigate this debate in Parliament to ensure that people who do scrutinise things like this at a political and legal level are aware of what's going on and that we are starting to get a proper debate about it.
Yeah, because, I mean, well, like you said at the start of this, I mean, it's very easy to just say, oh, well, these lyrics are violent, therefore they must be causing violence. Whereas, I mean, clearly, like, if you sit and think about it for a couple of seconds, it's clearly that these lyrics often just reflect the life that these, like, kids know. I mean, and it's an argument that's gone back throughout the history of rap, particularly, you know, like, gangster rap in the 90s, the kind of arguments that were particularly thrown against NWA. And they were just saying, well, this just reflects the life that we recognise around us. We're just talking about things that we see. And if you want to see something different, then you can make music and get out and do something different. It seems like a kind of a no-brainer, really.
So I mentioned that Diane Abbott was part of the debate, and she did sit on the fence to an extent after we'd had various artists and journalists very much laying in to what's been happening. Obviously, as an MP, also, she shadows the Home Secretary in Parliament. So obviously, police, etc., sits under that brief. So she was saying where there is direct incitement of violence, then understand that police need to investigate. But then she added, drill music can be violent. However, all of that said, she did state quite clearly that we know that the root cause of violence on our streets is much wider than music. And yes. I would probably go even further than that and say, isn't the music at all?
Yeah.
And there are a plethora of issues, most of which actually, and I mean, it's been interesting watching the sparring between the Mayor of London and the President of the United States on issues related to this is, as we've said, anyone who pays any attention to any of this will know that not only is this a much bigger thing than a music thing, also it's a problem created in certain boroughs in London on a local level, which is the result of national politics.
Yeah.
And the national politicians are now washing their hands of it and say, oh, this is all the fault of the local politicians and the London mayor because they're not doing enough to fix the problem that the national politicians created 10 years ago. Anyway, we've got kind of off topic there.
Well, not really.
But not really. And I would definitely go and check out the petition and obviously make your own decision on whether or not it's something you feel you should sign. But definitely keep an eye on everything that Crept and Conan are saying on this. It seems to me they're saying some very sensible stuff.
And finally this week, the chairman of Universal Music owner Vivendi, Yannick Bellore, has confirmed that the company's plan to sell up to 50% of its music business to a strategic partner is still very much underway and definitely happening.
Although, he was also keen to stress, there's no hurry.
Yeah, let's all chill.
We could do it next year. It's still on the agenda. It's still happening. We're still having conversations. But we're in no rush to offload 50% of the stock in the Universal Music Group. But it is still definitely going to happen at some point.
Yes. So Vivendi confirmed last July that what had been long speculated, and I think we discussed the speculation on the show prior to Vivendi actually announcing this, but it's decided it was going to sell up to 50% of its shares in the Universal Music Group. There was subsequently lots of speculation about who might step forward as a buyer for that. As we understand it, although there have been various different music companies mooted as possible partners, we understand that Vivendi wants kind of someone who's going to put up some money and then leave them alone, rather than someone who's going to be actively involved in the business.
Yes, and this was back in the news last week because it was the ad industry's junket in Cannes, the Cannes Lions event. So once the music industry has spent a week in Cannes doing the Midem thing, a couple of weeks later, the ad industry arrives. So the ad industry can have a week of chatting and networking and debating and
Patting itself
on the back. Yeah, and go and have nice dinners in the mountains just outside of Cannes and then have a really nasty allergic reaction to some pollen in the air and then have to go and lie on a sofa.
I think that might be a story quite specific to you.
Which is what happened when I was at Midem this year, which is a shame because it would have been a very nice dinner in the mountains had I not had to go and lie on a sofa instead. But Cannes Lions was happening. And the aforementioned Yannick Bellore was at that event because Vivendi, as well as owning the Universal Music Group and the Universal labels and publisher and merchandise businesses that become part of it, has other interests as well, including Havas, one of the big marketing groups. And Yannick actually heads up Havas.
Yeah.
He only took on the chairman's job at parent company Vivendi off his dad last year. So he was really in Cannes to talk about marketing and advertising stuff, and he was being interviewed by Bloomberg as a result of that. But in the interview, after waffling on about tedious ad industry stuff endlessly, he was asked about
Unilever. That was what he was there for.
It was what he was there for.
You might have not have found it that interesting, but it was what he was there for.
The interviewer asked him about the Universal sale. And it was interesting that the interviewer was sort of like, because of course you're planning on spinning Universal off and having it as a separate business. And he was very much, no, 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 that's not what we said. What we said was we are looking for a strategic and or financial partner who can help us to capitalise on growth in the music industry, which was kind of code for saying, we just want someone to take 50% of the business, to give us a load of cash in return for that, a chunk of which we would then spend on Universal itself to capitalise on the streaming boom, etc., etc. And so that is what they're looking for, hence why most people think that they don't really want to go into business. So, for example, Liberty Media, the big American company that has shares in lots of things, but is a significant shareholder and it controls SiriusXM in the US and therefore Pandora, also the biggest shareholder in Live Nation. So if it was to become a big shareholder in Universal, you might think, oh, Sirius, Pandora, Live Nation, Universal, there's lots of really exciting tie-ups we could do there, which I'm sure the Department of Justice in America would love to tear apart on competition law grounds. But you sort of sense that what Vivendi wants is not that, although they are talking about strategic partners, but really they just want someone to say, here's a load of cash, so you can pay a load to your shareholders, and then you can spend the rest growing the Universal business as the streaming boom continues. And that was kind of what the boss was saying in this interview.
Yeah, so he said, the music industry is going through a huge period of growth. The business is thriving and we want to make sure that we can accelerate this growth in the coming years. For now, we have communicated that we want to open a process before the end of 2019 and all the management of Vivendi are confident that that will happen. So that's like, yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to get right on it. But then he went on, we're not in a hurry. Vivendi is doing very well. Universal is doing very well. The question is how to find the right partner. Once again, everything's fine. Trust me.
He is French and so said it with a French accent, rather than whatever accent you were using.
I'm using, that was all my own intonation.
In that.
I can say it different. Once again, everything's fine. Trust me.
Yes.
I should have done it in that voice.
Very much not how he speaks. But there you go. So it's definitely on. They're definitely going to be properly, formally talking to potential strategic financial partners later this year. But we don't know when a deal would happen. And to an extent, you can understand why Vivendi aren't necessarily in any interest to sell shares in Universal just yet, because the streaming boom continues. The amount of money coming in to the music industry at large and therefore to Universal every month from the streaming services continues to go up month on month. Investors and Wall Street types and bankers keep publishing documents with ludicrously ambitious projections for either where the music industry and the record industry is headed next, or specifically to the value of Universal Music and the catalogues it's sitting on. So it does feel like for the next year at least, we're going to get more and more positive statements coming out about the state of music rights and of Universal, which can only mean, you would assume, that the money they could squeeze out of selling up to 50% of Universal Music will go up. So you can understand why they aren't necessarily seeing this as a top urgent priority that they need to deal with.
That said, you want to add a little bit of pessimism in, which I assume you do. There is probably a point at which it's too late, because obviously the streaming boom is happening. There's lots and lots of money coming in from streaming. The record industry is now more than 50% propped up by streaming. That's where all the money's coming from. But all of the streaming companies aren't really making any profit themselves, and that's an issue.
And while I think you'd have to be super pessimistic to think that that means the streaming services are all going to crash and burn in the next 2 years and there'll be no streaming market.
That's not what I'm saying.
But obviously, the majors' deals with Spotify are coming up for renewal, and people will scrutinise what happens at that stage, because Spotify has a much stronger negotiating hand than it ever has done before. Clearly, it needs to increase its margins to go into profit. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with those deals and whether or not it will be good for Vivendi to get this sale done before that deal or after that deal. Will depend on how that deal turns out for the two sides. So yes, it remains to be seen quite where the streaming market goes next in terms of the continued growth, but also the changing relationship between the streaming services and the music companies.
There are other things that could concern potential investors.
Yeah, so I suppose really Universal Music's core value comes from the catalogue of recordings and songs that it controls, and actually the most valuable copyrights are the ones that it owns and the ones that it will own for as long as those copyrights exist. And because the way that deals are done between songwriters and publishers have changed a lot in the last 25 years, meanwhile, the deals between labels and recording artists are also slowly starting to change. We're getting to a point where, when it comes to newer music, especially songs, but I think eventually recordings as well, record companies won't control those works for life of copyright. They'll control those works for like 10 years, and then the works will revert to the artists and the songwriters, and they can do whatever they like with it. That already happens with songs. I think it will slowly but surely start to happen with recordings as well. So actually, the real value is in the 20th century catalogue, both songs and recordings, where life of copyright deals were the norm, and where, generally speaking, the deals were much more skewed towards the labels and the publishers in terms of how the money got shared. So that 20th century catalogue is really valuable. Now, in theory, that catalogue won't last forever because copyright is meant to expire, although generally in Europe and the US, as soon as any valuable copyrights look like they're going to expire, the music industry does a pretty good job of getting those copyrights extended so the copyrights continue. But there is some litigation going through the courts that could have an impact on Universal's control of that 20th century catalogue, already under American copyright law, with song copyrights, 35 years after a publisher acquiring song copyrights off a songwriter. The writer has a one-off opportunity to terminate the assignment, albeit, as it has been interpreted, only the American rights in those songs, but that is already happening. But crucially, we have some test cases going through the court that would extend that principle to recordings as well as songs, and potentially to songs and recordings that were assigned to a Universal in the UK or elsewhere rather than in the US. There isn't time to explain all those termination rights cases at the moment.
We have discussed it before.
We have discussed it before on Set List. But if all of those cases that are currently working their way through the courts happen to go in the favour of the artists and the writers, it's by no means assured that they will. But if they did, a company like Universal could find itself over a period of 10 to 20 years losing significant portions of that super lucrative 20th century catalogue on which the whole business is kind of built. That is the foundations of the business. So, in some ways, cash in those shares before any of that shit happens.
Yeah. Now, the other big Universal story that's been going on, and we discussed last week, is the warehouse fire on the Universal Studios backlot in 2008 and what damage that may have done to Universal Music's archive master recordings.
Yeah, so quick recap. Although that was the Universal Film Studios property, and by 2008, Universal Music and Universal Studios were two separate companies, but the record company was still storing a load of master tapes at that Hollywood site. It was all burnt down. The reason we're talking about it 11 years later is at the time, most of the media attention was on the impact on the film business. The music side kind of played down quite how much damage there had been to the Universal Music sound recordings archive. We then had a New York Times article quite recently saying it was a much bigger impact than anybody knew.
I mean, they were saying possibly up to 500,000 master recordings destroyed.
We talked about that on last week's podcast. Actually, last week's podcast went out a little bit late because Andy Malt wouldn't let me publish it. I think that was the problem.
I don't think that.
Was that the problem?
No, I don't.
Pretty sure that was the problem. So by the time you heard us talking about that story last week on Setlist, various other things had happened, both in terms of ambulance-chasing lawyers coming out of the woodwork saying, oh, could there be some litigation on this? And Universal Music, which initially very much played down the New York Times article and said, oh, it's exaggerated. Lots of allegations in that article aren't true. The fire was not as damaging as everyone is now saying. Universal have put out some other statements in which they're still kind of sticking to that line, but they are being a little bit more upfront, particularly with their artists, on what recordings were lost.
Yes, yeah, so one of the things that happened was, I mean, it wasn't a public statement, but Lucian Grainge, big boss of Universal Music, sent out a memo to staff basically saying, because of this article, we've had a lot of artists panicking that their master recordings have been destroyed, particularly because this New York Times article in some of those cases will have said that they have been. And he was saying that although he wasn't in charge of Universal when this happened, he said he was going to own this now and he was going to make sure artists got answered. He was saying we need to be transparent with artists. He set up a team to respond to any queries so that artists can ring up and find out what master recordings still exist and what, if anything, has been destroyed.
As we discussed last week, Universal are very much saying, and actually the New York Times article already conceded this point, that any recordings sitting on those master tapes that have been commercially released will sit somewhere else in the archive.
Yeah.
Either on another physical format or actually in many cases digitized, sitting on a hard disk. So the commercially released albums that were sitting on those destroyed master tapes are not really affected unless you buy the New York Times articles aside that maybe the version on the original masters would be of higher quality. But I suppose of more interest is, were there other tracks, performances at those recording sessions, which were never released anywhere, which maybe one day somebody would have gone through that tape, found a track, which with hindsight they thought should have gone out in public, and now, because those master tapes are dead, those tracks will never be released. And in their more recent statements, Universal, although not explicitly stating that that unreleased material is lost, are kind of conceding that it might be.
Yeah, although there was an interesting interview with Universal Senior Vice President of Recording Studios and Archive Management, Pat Krause, who has been tasked with leading this team to work out on behalf of artists what is still safe. And he was talking in quite a lot of detail about how the archive management works. And I mean, throughout all of this, Universal has taken every opportunity to talk up how much money it invests in archive management and technology to ensure everything is safe. But he was saying that, like, although master recordings could have been lost in this fire, there would have been other types of things there. So they would have been backup recordings. They would have been different versions of mixes, just documentation, things like that, not necessarily the actual masters. And he was also saying, if you want to go back and remaster a record for re-release, the master recording isn't necessarily the best quality recording to go for. It might have been played quite a lot already. It might have degraded. So you might have a backup copy that is actually a better quality version, and that might still be safe.
Because that possibly wasn't stored at the Hollywood studio base.
Yes, so because we already knew that some of the stuff had been moved off-site already, so we don't know exactly what was in that warehouse, and publicly we may never know that.
And I suppose Lucian Grange's point was, while we may not have a right to know what masters are missing, the artists whose performances are on those tapes possibly do. And so the commitment being made was, we're going to invest a bit of time, have some people, a bit of resource, so that any artist who has a query about whether or not their masters were involved in that fire and what recordings are still on file, somebody will answer the phone, respond to the email and tell them.
Which at least is good, because we did have some artists respond to that article saying, oh, well, this explains why I've never been able to get a proper answer as to where my master recordings are. And it seems now that Universal is responding to that and it's going to make sure it knows where, or in fact where not, those archived recordings now sit.
Actually, it wouldn't surprise me if the people who do the archiving and look after the archive at Universal, which Lucian Grange was very keen to remind us, invested a lot in that over the years, but I suspect the archivers might be thinking, actually, this is kind of done as a favour, because we're going to get the budget, we're going to get the resource. Because lots of those big music companies, as I think we talked about on last week's set list, they're sitting on a lot of recordings, a lot of rights, which they acquired over the years. They don't really know what they've got. It is quite a lot of work, actually, to be going through filing cabinets and boxes and chests full of tapes and DATs and mini discs and all of that. So maybe if they get a little bit more resource, they can do a better job of what they were hired to do in the first place.
Yes, although I should say that in his interview, Pat Krause did say that it's not the case, as has been reported in some places, that record label archiving, certainly in Universal's case, is sort of like Raiders of the Lost Ark, just a big warehouse of boxes. No one knows what's in them. He was saying, no, we do really have quite a good system now where we do know what's where. But certainly, you know, a bit of extra budget to go and fully check that stuff out.
And maybe even put it in a database somewhere so everyone else can know.
But that is all we've got time for this week. We need to go and spruce up the setlist archive under Chris's desk and check what we've got and what we haven't. That hasn't caught fire yet, has it?
Hasn't caught fire. Quick reference there to last week's set list.
Good news. But if you have any questions or comments about this week's show, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk or track us down on social media. We're Setlist Pod in most places. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook, produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.